Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. The Census Bureau's population figures came out this week, and the numbers revealed that people, and as a result, political clout, are moving away from the Northeast. Due to population declines, New York and New Jersey are among the states that will lose seats in Congress, with New York losing two seats and New Jersey losing one. And as they do every 10 years, when new census data emerges, state legislatures will redraw boundaries for congressional districts. So watch out. This process needs to be completed before the 2012 elections, and the highly political process known as redistricting may just be coming to a neighborhood near you. Here with us to talk about what to expect next is our very own Bob Henley. Hey, Bob.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here, Bob, because this is one of those questions that very few Americans can really get their minds around, and there's nobody better to explain it to us than you. Now, you just posted about this on our political website. It's a freecountry.org in a piece titled "The Northeast Slide Continues." Doesn't sound good, Bob. What does the population shift mean for those of us who live in New York or New Jersey?
Well, I guess you have to also put it in the regional context that you have Massachusetts on the losing end of this particular narrative, Pennsylvania, Ohio. So there is something afoot here in the sense of just how much are we going to be able to be at the table when it comes to long-term national priorities. Now, we've spoken on this program before about this phenomena where in the Northeast, and actually it was the late Senator Moynihan who really focused on this, we get a very poor rate of return as it is now under the existing power structure. It's usually some 60 cents on the dollar, I think, Connecticut and New Jersey do-si-do for the indignity of being last in 49th. New York is somewhere also in the backfield. And so what's happened over a period of time in the post-World War II environment is generally the subsidy of development of the South and West. So you get $1.10 and $1.15 in some places. For instance, we have things like the Tennessee Valley Authority established in the time of the Depression to settle Tennessee. Well, I've seen pictures, and it's settled now, but those subsidies still exist.
Well, let's talk specifically about the population losses. Where were the biggest population losses in New York? It feels like there are a lot of people here.
Well, the thing is that it's actually to be – we just didn't grow as fast as the rest of the nation, to be quite specific about it. In New Jersey, there's a population of 8.8 million. We went up 4.55%. That's less than half, though, than the national average, which was 9.7. Now, in New York, it was really anemic, where it was like 2.19%, and we actually had a net loss of population in places like Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse. And so really what's happened is the disinvestment in America's manufacturing base, all those proud industrial cities that made things, now as that's kind of receded, have been shipped overseas and outsourced, the population is going to where opportunity exists. Now, that's changed a little bit because now with what's happening with the housing bubble, there's not the same ability to migrate. But these trends have been well in place even before the Great Recession.
Well, do we know yet then, Bob, which districts will lose, say, in New York, two seats, or in New Jersey, the one seat?
Well, there is speculation that upstate districts, one held by Brian Higgins and Louise Slaughter, both Democrats, that's going to be difficult. In New Jersey, where you'll have a situation where it will most likely, most political scientists think that John Runyon, who just got elected in the third district there in South Central Jersey, he beat the incumbent there, John Adler, who himself had just been elected in the Obama landslide in New Jersey. And then in the 7th district, which is in the midsection, Leonard Lance, a Republican who was just elected in 2008, did very well in the last election, but he's in, he's a newbie. And one of the things that happens in this process, at least, is there's a kind of a deference in the process to those with seniority. And there is some kind of perverse sense to that. For instance, if you have a Congressman Rodney Frelinghuysen, who is from Morris County, he's getting up there in seniority, so he has an important position in the Appropriations Committee. Doesn't make much sense to toss him overboard. Then if you have a Scott Garrett, the conservative congressman from northern New Jersey, he's now in the process of ascending to the chairmanship of the Markets Committee, certainly central to our region. So there's a lot of calculations to get involved here.
Well, this is why I said it's good to have you here. Let's talk about the process. Explain redistricting. How does it work?
Oh, sure. Well, here's the thing. You know what, Jamie? It's like snowflakes. Each state is different. The thing about it is that in New York, we have a circumstance where the Assembly creates their districts, and that has been dominated by Speaker Silver and the Democrats forever and a day, probably before there were stairs. And then on the Republican side in the Senate, which up until just this last term historically was dominated by the Republicans, they draw up separate Senate districts that have always served the institutional and partisan interests of the Republicans. And so that's the way it works. Now, in New Jersey, there's a whole different schematic. You have legislative districts. So it's also important to understand that when you're doing this redistricting, it's not just the congressional boundaries you're defining. It is the state legislative area that you're also setting up for the next 10 years. But in New Jersey, I'm proud to say, there's a little more common sense in that you have one senator and two assembly people in one district. And so there you don't have this kind of thing where it's such a – and also we have a bipartisan commission, so to speak, that does this. And it's six members of from the Republicans, six members from the Democrats, and the all-important nonpartisan tiebreaker. And so that's how we've kind of meandered through history. Now, this still results, though, in going before the federal judiciary because nobody's ever happy with either process.
And Bob, in your essay you write, and I'm going to quote, I hope you don't mind,
not at all.
And quote, because of well-documented past violations of the U.S. Voting Rights Act, any redistricting that impacts the Bronx, Queens, or Brooklyn must also be approved by the U.S. Department of Justice, end quote. Now, what's that all about, Bob?
Well, in 1965, basically what it comes down to, the 14th Amendment did not include a prohibition against discrimination in voting. Oh, we forgot it. And so it required, after all the things that had happened in the South, where, as we know, through the struggles of Dr. King and the whole civil rights movement, there was an attempt, an overt attempt, systematic attempt to keep African Americans away from the polls by force of local law. This 1965 Voting Rights Act was a watershed law, and that it empowered the Department of Justice to intervene. And over the years, it has come to include folks that are like language minority folks. So in Spanish-speaking districts, in Asian-American areas, you can't discriminate. Now, there's an interesting dynamic tension here, because the idea here is to make sure there's a kind of tension that develops, if you will. We want to have underrepresented minorities, so you want to make sure that, I guess in essence, that it's a sure thing that in those districts they'll get elected. On the other hand, there's a tension for a competitive election, irrespective of race. And I submit to you, that's the polarity we're working through right now, because after all, right now, we've come a little bit of a distance from 1965. We have, after all, elected an African-American president, and the assumption behind the 1965 Voting Rights Act, correct as it was in that period of time, is that people would not vote for someone of a different color.
Hmm. Do we have the data used for redistricting on race and neighborhood populations yet?
They're refining it.
From the census?
Right. We'll be getting in the next couple of months even more granular detail about it.
Hmm. All right. Let's listen to what New York Senator-elect Mike Gennaris, he's also the new head of the Democrat Senate Campaign Committee. Let's listen to what he had to say, because it's kind of interesting, about redistricting earlier in the week, Bob.
Redistricting is critical. There is no single change we can make that would more instill faith in our government from the people of the state of New York than ridding ourselves once and for all of partisan gerrymandering. It has been a plague on the political process in this state for far too long, and it has bastardized the districts that people run in and represent. There's a line that I'm sure Citizens Union will quote because they always say it, but we now have a situation where the elected officials choose their voters instead of the voters choosing their elected officials, and that's just plain wrong. That's got to stop, and it starts on January 1, when we get back into Albany for the new session.
Now, Bob, in your piece for itsafreecountry.org, you also write about Citizens Union and former Mayor Ed Koch driving this idea to create an independent commission to redraw the legislative and congressional districts. We just touched on that, that reflect this 2010 census. And the idea has a support of the majority of the legislature, and Governor-elect Andrew Cuomo has endorsed it. So that's a done deal, right?
No. And here's the thing about this. I have to say that, you know, Mayor Koch has been quite a public servant historically. This is really quite a valedictory lap. This is when you look at the list, it's not just they're dealing with ethics and all other kinds of transparency issues, but they identified, and I think correctly so, that this was a central issue because what they want to do is create, they're using the models of, I think, Arizona and Iowa, where there's truly a nonpartisan, impartial panel that puts together what the districts look like. Because what ends up happening over time is it serves the political class as their argument, and that's why you have a high return of incumbencies or incumbents all the time. And so you might want to use other things to define polity. What do I mean by that? I mean communities of interest. It would be ridiculous. If you have a regional school district, for instance, maybe you throw that in the mix and make sure that you include the people that are in that regional school district as opposed to dividing it into separate municipalities just to serve the long-term professional interest of a particular politician.
But in Arizona, for example, Bob, they had a historical reason, the Hopi-Navajo dilemma, that caused all participants to want that independent commission. That's kind
right.
of a unique situation. We don't have that here. I mean, what does Cuomo need to do to implement that kind of commission to make it happen? I mean, do you really think it's going to happen?
I know you're a lawyer, but in Arizona, it went on for 7 years.
Uh-huh.
That's like, you know, a Charles Dickens Jarndyce versus Jarndyce case. in the case of New York, though, it's going to have to require that he not sign whatever comes out of the legislature if he you know keeps his commitment that he won't sign anything that reflects this gerrymandered tradition.
So do you think that Citizens Union is good governance organization, is a good governance organization that's behind the idea?
I think
you mentioned that you think this is Ed Koch's valedictory run around his final
look
lap.
At the list. Well, even if it's not, I'm sure that there are partisans who represent the Democratic and Republican Party who can say that this is a way to get people animated and to participate. There is a pushback. There's always two sides to every story. The New York Uprising agenda is actually much broader than this, so that's why I mentioned that it's so substantial. I mean, you do have a situation where you look at incumbency. Now, one of the things that I think has more to do with or as much to do with incumbency is the phenomenon of campaign finance. And when you see here in the city council in New York City where we now have publicly financed campaigns that provide an opportunity for the public and small denominations to participate and rewards that kind of broad-based campaign contribution success, we've seen turnover occur. So there's got to be some combination of, again, the idea of coming up with districts that make sense based on the geography and the way we live. I mean, for that matter, I've always wondered why is it that we don't have, as a requirement in some other parts of the world, that we have one woman and one man come from each district. Can you imagine what a transfer? No, I'm serious. So, I mean, because you know what? This is about reimagining ourselves to be more representative of the society that we're in.
Reimagining ourselves, Bob. Eternal optimist. Let's talk a bit about New Jersey. This is the first time, a little bit more specifically about New Jersey. I heard you say earlier that you thought the process there is perhaps a bit closer to the ideal. This is the first time, isn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong. I may have my history wrong. But isn't it the first time in a couple of decades that New Jersey has lost a seat?
I think it's like 1990. I mean, I think we were at 17 at one point. Now we're down to 13. I mean, our neighbor, though, I mean, New York, I think at one point you were the big dog at 45. I mean, so now you're down to 27. It's quite something.
So you mentioned that it's a bipartisan congressional district that will decide.
Panel, right.
Panel, I'm sorry, that will decide which district will be on the chopping block. So why is Governor Christie saying that he expects the fight to be, quote, intensely partisan?
Are you just quoting him right now?
The intensely.
Okay. And so your question would be captured on YouTube. I mean, there's no doubt that behind the scenes, I mean, right now we're in a situation where they did pick up to give the Republicans, credit. They did. It had been 8-5 Democratic. It's now 7-6 Democratic. And so they would be remiss if they didn't press their advantage and try to make a case that, they don't want to see the Democrats use this as an opportunity to, again, gerrymander. I mean, one of the things, if you look at it, is that you still do have the state legislature is in control by the Democrats. And so there will be a dynamic tension there. Listen, it can all come down to something like just saying to an incumbent senator, I mean, an incumbent congressman, would you like to go on the Port Authority? I mean, Jamie, that's how it's done, right? I mean, it's not, you know, that's what I'm saying.
No,
I mean,
comment.
It's feudalism in some sense. It's like, give him something else to do.
All right. Now, Bob, I only have a couple minutes left, but I promise myself to reserve time for two final questions, and I'm so pleased that I have you for these two at the end of the year, because it's the last time that we will chat in the year 2010. So I must ask you, put you on the spot a little bit, what was, for you, the biggest story that you covered this year? Now, that's a tough question, given your beat, but how you want to define biggest story you covered this year, but for you, the most significant story of 2010.
I think it's because it's had so many different facets to it, is the continuing pressure and collapse of the public balance sheet in the form of the chronic fiscal crisis that exists in all of our municipalities, our counties, our cities, and our states. And also looking more globally, that this is really, and I think Prime Minister Brown has a book out that makes this case more eloquently than I might, is that you are at a circumstance where capital now in this crisis is truly global. And what we see is, with a click of a mouse, currency can move around the world, and the regulatory and accountability mechanism is truly 19th century snail mail. That means, and I'm not saying there's anything untoward about it, but it's just physics, that capital can move around the world, and, you know, they can say things like, well, you know, Greece, we really don't like that social contract you have. Your workers are too well paid, and people are staying home too much. We're going to sell off your currency today. See you later. We'll come back tomorrow and see if you've done better. So you really have a tipping of the balance here, if you will, where the sovereign nation state is like the concierge to capital. I don't know how else to say it, but that's where we are.
Yeah, and you may have anticipated my next question, but I will ask it anyway for our listeners in the WMYC listening area. What are you looking forward to covering, and what will they be looking out for in 2011 in terms of big stories?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that in New Jersey, the municipalities are really up against it. We're seeing a situation where January 1, a 2% property tax cap goes into effect. Of course, there's all kinds of exclusions. Sounds like a card, except for the double-digit increase in health care costs for public employees, pensions, and debt service. But still, I'm going to be very interested to see how the local governments work through what is going to be a prolonged crisis. And I say this both for New Jersey and New York. It's also going to be a very challenging time for nonprofits. One of the things people may not fully grasp is that both in New Jersey and New York, around the country, government has been increasingly turning to nonprofits for very important social service needs, whether it be visiting nurses, whether it be child care, whether it be elder care. And we're going to see a real constriction on these, on the money to these services. And the question is, do people rise to the occasion in a kind of de Tocqueville tradition, if you will, and start getting more engaged? Because that's a problem right now, is people are used to government taking care of these things. And Jamie, I just think we're going to be faced with the challenge that they're not going to be there.
Hmm. Well, Bob, it's been a real treat to spend part of this last hour with you.
Thanks.
Bob Henley, WMYC. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.
And to read Bob's article, you can go to itsafreecountry.org. His latest piece, The Northeast Slide Continues. And I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next, two physicists take on New York City. Stay with us.